So we are looking at the faces of the Z2 quantum lattice gauge theory. So what do we have? We have our gauge transformations and our gauge invariant Hilbert space. Okay, and we have our Hamiltonian, which is the sum over the Plaquette operators and a transverse magnetic field. Where the Plaquette operator is the product of sigma z around the Plaquette. Okay. We have seen that G equals zero is a trivial paramagnet. J equals zero is a trivial paramagnet. And G equals zero is this phase that has a fourfold degeneracy, and then it's gapped away by 4J. And you can, the excitations are localized in the sense that it means that there is a minus one at the Plaquette P. Okay, and you can have only an even number of such excitations. One important thing to understand is to understand what is the algebra within the ground state. Okay, so our ground state manifold is the span of these four states that, let me use this notation. Okay, so this means all the BPs are one. And then you have W1z, W2z, with these two numbers that have two values that you can call 0 and 1. Or plus one and minus one. Okay, so what is this algebra? So we know this must be a qubit. It must be a spin one half. Simply because we know that each of these quantum numbers is labeling a system of two states. So we already know that the algebra must be the algebra of the polymatrices. And therefore, if we say that the operator WZ, which was this one, and so if this is the quantum number for a qubit, then the algebra should be realized by, there should be another operator, let me call it W1x, that squares to the identity, just like W1z, and anti-commutes with this one. Right? Because this is the algebra of a two-level system. So this operator must exist, which is an operator, the algebra within L. So this operator not only must commute with all the gauge transformations, but must not take you outside of this system. So it also has to commute with all the BPs, right? W1x BP also must commute. And similarly for the other two-level system, for this one. So you would have the same situation. So also for the other one. Right? Do you agree? So any suggestion what this operator is?
Spins on our slice one?
Yes. So if you look now at the non-contractible loop on the dual lattice, so remember it would be something that goes in the dual lattice like this and carries x. This obviously commutes with the gauge transformations because it's made of x. Let's see if it commutes with all the BPs. And you see that also the non-contractible one will commute with all the BPs because for every plaquette, it does always this. So it will anti-commute twice, and therefore it will commute. OK. But what is the behavior of this operator with this one? As you can see, they only meet in one place. So they have the same algebra of sigma x and sigma z, where they meet, which is what we wrote here. Okay.
So is it a horizontal W1z or W2z?
So what I mean here is that, right, that W1x, which is
is
this one, is the one that will anti-commute with W1z, and W2x is the one that does anti-commute with W2x. So you see that if you take the state in here that is made of 0, 0, means by 0 here I mean that this is an eigenstate of eigenvalue plus 1 of W1z, whereas the one of eigenvalues minus 1, I call it 1. Because in the end, it's like the algebra of the polymatrices. And similarly for W2. So if this is the state 0, 0, then I get here to the state 1, 0 by acting with the W1x. And if this is the state at 0, 1, I get from here to here with the W2x. And if this is 1, 1, this would be W1x, W2x. And similarly for the other transitions, yes?
Why do we have the dual lattice? Why do we have the, like, these loops on top of the dual lattices? Why do we need this?
We need to understand in the ground space what is the algebra. Well, so your question is, why do we need to understand that, or why this is the algebra?
No, so we started with our lattice, and now we are looking at these loops on the dual lattice. I'm asking, why do we need to look them on the dual lattice? Like first, we didn't have, we just have W1z, W2z. Now we are working with W1.
Because I defined the strings carrying x on the dual lattice to start with, remember? So this is how I define them. Now your question could be, but why you started that way? Okay, so imagine I have the strings running, both of them, on the lattice, not on the dual lattice. So the commutation relations between these two objects will be trivial, right? These two things always commute or anti-commute, depending whether your lattice, if L is even or odd. Whereas this green one and this red one, now they actually don't cross. Do you see that they actually don't cross? The lines cross, but the supports of the two operators do not cross, right? This one is operating on these spins. This one is operating on these other two spins. So they're completely trivial. They just commute because they have nothing to do. So this would not be very useful. But, you know, sigma in the algebra of a qubit, you call x the operator that flips the value of z, and vice versa. And it is this pair of operators that do that. That's the algebra of a two-level system or of a qubit. But now we see that L can be written in this way, like the span of the state 0, 0, and now I put here W1x, W2x, to the power A and B, with A, B taking values 0 and 1. Do you see? This is a way of writing these four states, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, and 1, 1. So as you can see, the algebra of the ground space is completely realized by these topologically non-trivial operators. Okay? And that's why this ground space that has this topological character makes this phase non-trivial. It's not like the paramagnet. And we call it a topologically ordered phase. One consequence of this is this degeneracy actually depends on the topology of the space in which your lattice is embedded. Because, so let me classify here some different Riemann surfaces. You get the gist? Okay. So if I do this construction again on a sphere, how many non-contractible loops do I have? Zero. All the loops that I can draw on a sphere can be shrinked to a point, always staying on the sphere.
What if you have one around the equator?
Well, yeah, you shrink it like this, right? You move it and you shrink it up to the pole. But if you're like this, see, it's a topological difference.
Is there any manifold that only contains one single, uncontractible?
No. In G equals zero, there is no non-contractible loop. G equals one, there are two. G equal 2, there are 4. So you see that the degeneracy of the ground space, so it's a topological degeneracy. So it's not a degeneracy that depends on symmetry breaking, because these four states all have the same symmetry. No symmetry is broken. There is no local order parameter that takes a different value in one of the four possible states. It's topological and indeed does depend on the topology. Yes?
If we take the planar, if we remove one point, what's the value of G?
Oh, yeah. So then if in a sphere you remove one point, I think this becomes like a torus.
If you remove one point, it's an R2 plane. If we remove two points, it's a cylinder.
Right. Yeah. So one point.
Lose these two points, it's again a torus.
Yeah, correct. Good, thanks. Okay.
I also have questions.
Sure.
Our construction only applies to the torus one, because torus can be expanded to plane.
No, so you can do that. You can repeat this construction on other Riemann surfaces, but it will not be a square lattice. But you still have all the same algebra. I can refer to some literature if you want to see explicitly how it looks like. I mean, it is an unnecessary complication to see more complicated lattices. You know, I'm doing it on the square lattice because, you know, we see all the important elements without unnecessary complications about the shape of these things. But yeah, I'll come to you in a second. So just to make clear, imagine that you have something less regular. But you can still, with some choice, you will still be able to tessellate any Riemann surface. And you still can define black hats and stars, and you see that no matter what, our intersections that are always 0 or 2, which is the K element, is always true. So any tessellation that works will be good.
I think Remy's question is about now we only care about non-zero genus. What about if we have non-zero punctures, like one punctures or three, two, yeah, one punctures or two punctures, not closed.
Yeah. So if you remove a site.
Yes.
If you remove a site, it means you're removing these four spins. Then yes, you also have degeneracies due to that.
Yes.
And I think it is.
You don't have the lattice anymore.
I think that the degeneracy due to that is just two. I need to check.
I mean, you can do this with on a plane as well. Not periodic boundary condition.
Yeah, so if you put it on the plane, then you have to establish some boundary conditions and then you have different ground states corresponding to different boundary conditions. Okay. Okay, so this is interesting. So we have something, a degeneracy that is not symmetry breaking. And what happens now if G is not exactly zero? Now, I would like to do perturbation theory like we learned with the Ising model. And I would like to know whether these things that we're finding are a characteristic of just that particular point or of a full phase. For instance, is there a quantum phase transition for some value of the ratio G over J? And how do correlation functions behave in the full phase? Okay, so a good way to argue about this is to use, again, duality. And, okay, so... I don't remember what notation I used in the notes. But let me take one of these lines as a reference line, okay? We call it O. And I will have something similar in the other direction. So this is OX and this is OY. Okay. And now, imagine that I have, for every P, I have two types of strings, starting from OX that goes vertically and carries X, because these are strings on the dual lattice, and one starting from OY and moving in the X direction, like this. Okay. So now let's try to use a good notation. I have a good notation in the notes that I forgot. So this would be the product of L greater than O alpha of sigma x L in the, let me use this, in the alpha direction. So, and alpha takes the two values, direction x and direction y. And this goes from L to P. Okay, and let me call this operator, let me call it mu 3 P. mu 3 alpha, right? Because alpha is left free as a parameter.
Y3 is a parameter. Y is 3 of alpha.
Y3? It's a name.
Okay.
It's a name. Because I do not want to use X and Z because there are too many X and Z. But okay, so you know this operator is labeled by alpha because it can be this one or this one. And now let me call this other operator BP. Let me call it mu one. Since without alpha, of p. Okay, let's understand the algebra of these operators. Okay, now you know we have some experience in doing these things. You see that they square to the identity, right? Mu 3 alpha of p squared is the identity. Because it's a product of polymatrices, and the same for mu 1, because it's BP, and BP squares to the identity. Yeah?
Can you just repeat? So this first operator we're defining, so it's either going to be going up or sideways. That's it.
Yes, okay. Correct. And if I want to be completely consistent, if I'm going in the up direction, this means that the reference line is the x1, so I should say alpha bar, the other one. Mm-hmm. Or I should simply call this one, okay, maybe this is easier. But you know, this is just an exercise in notation, it's not something very profound. Okay. So they square to the identity. Now let's try to understand their commutation rules. So you see that if mu 3 and mu 1 act on different sides, so you see you have a string that arrives at P, and then you look at another P, another plaquette, a plaquette at a different P, they have to commute. But if P is equal to P prime, then you have this string, is the string at P, or it is this string at P, and this plaquette. And in both cases, they have one spin in common, and they will anti-commute. So for every value of alpha, mu 3 alpha P and mu 1 of P, anti-commute. Therefore, these are spin variables. And now, in the new variables, we can write the Hamiltonian. Okay, so you see that our Hamiltonian is mapped through duality to a new Hamiltonian. So let's find out what it is. It's minus J, the sum over P of mu 1 P, minus G, the sum on alpha, so both the x and the y direction, of this object, right? So this j in a square lattice are the j's. This, you know, the one in the y direction, and those in the x direction, right? So we, this is the sum over all of them. So you see, I'm writing sum over alpha. This means first I look at those in the x direction, then those in the y direction, the vertical spins and the horizontal spins. So now you see that sigma x on a vertical spin is given by this string this is P, this is the plaquette, times this string. It's the trick we did before when we looked at the duality of the 1D Ising model. The product of these two strings is the identity up to here. And then it's finally sigma x on the vertical spin. And similarly in the y direction. So this is going to be the product of mu 3 p minus 1 mu 3 p, and then I sum over all the p's. Do you agree? And this p carries an index alpha, right? Because I'm numbering the spins in the y direction first, and then in the x directions. OK, good. OK, so now these are spin operators. And this is just the quantumizing model in two directions, in two spatial dimensions. There is a little subtlety here because we know the dimension of the Hilbert space is 2 to the L squared plus 1. And here, this is an Hamiltonian that is using as degrees of freedom only the plaquettes. So, you know, the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian are only spanning a 2 to the L squared minus 1 space. So this means that this mapping, you have to do it for every sector. Okay? So you freeze these degrees of freedom, and for every sector, you do this mapping. Okay. So within a sector. Okay, now this is very interesting because now we can borrow the knowledge that we have about the quantumizing model to argue about the phases of the lattice gauge theory. For instance, we know that for J large, this is the paramagnet of the mu spins. If this is a paramagnet of the mu spins, this means that every operator that is made of mu 3 will have expectation value 0 because it's a paramagnet. Right? This is what we learned. So for j greater than critical, we have that we have the paramagnet. In the icing theory, quantum icing 2D, which means that mu 3 is equal to 0, and the correlation functions mu 3 at P, mu 3 at P prime, will be exponentially decaying. Right? Yeah?
Can you please explain again how this the second term came about? I didn't quite see how it's just coming from the duality of the lattice. Like, so I see sigma xj over there, and over here we have p, v.
Okay, So say again, you want to understand this part or what I'm saying now?
Yeah, that part.
That part.
The second term where you have like a product of the mu's.
Oh, okay. So in the theory, I have the g term. I have to map that term. That term is made of either sigma x on these spins or sigma x on these spins. But what is mu? Mu is a string of x's. So the product, so this is a string that arrives at P, right? The string that arrives at P minus 1 in this direction is x, 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 x. So the product of these two strings is x. Okay, so here I was saying j, yeah, j, so this is j over g, that must be greater than jc of some critical value. Okay, so when the first term is involved, then we have a paramagnet in the icing variables. Okay. Which means that, you know, there is no symmetry breaking, no spontaneous symmetry breaking, and mu 3p is 0. And actually, not only mu 3p is 0, but well, okay. So now let's go the other. Let's look at the other limit. When j over g is smaller than the critical value, then we are in the symmetry breaking phase of the mu variables, which means we have a long range order in the mu variables. But especially, this means that mu 1 is mu 3, the one that breaks the symmetry. Oh no, it's mu 1, the one that breaks. Yeah, so here too, I was wrong. So when we have the paramag, no, mu 3 is the one that breaks the symmetry. Okay, I'm saying okay. So, sorry. Now we are in symmetry breaking, so mu3p is different from zero. Okay, so here in the Ising variables, this is the magnetization. But if I translate in the language of the topological phase, okay, this means that this product has expectation value different from zero. So you see there is a condensation, means expectation value different from zero in the ground state, of these strings. So it's not something local that is getting a different from zero order. This is called condensation of kinks.
Why is it?
So the topologically ordered phase which one is the topologically ordered phase? Is the one where J is large, right? So corresponds to the paramagnet. Okay, so this is mapped by duality in the topologically ordered phase.
Sorry, in the mu picture, which symmetry do we have?
So in the Ising model, the symmetry is a global symmetry Z2. And the operator that breaks the symmetry is mu1. Is mu3.
Do we have gauge symmetry?
Yeah, whose products it likes.
In the mu variables, there is no gauge, in the mu variables, there is no gauge symmetry.
Why is that?
So, I'm not sure. So why there should be
before the duality you have the gauge symmetry. So I think after duality you cannot.
Well, before I do have what does it mean? So remember, what is a gauge symmetry? We are just saying that the BP operators commute with AP.
Yes.
And we are saying that the states. So if I act with A on a state, I get the same state. Okay, so if here we act with A, let me see in these variables what A should be.
Yeah, the mu3 doesn't commute with A.
Then yeah, that does not commute. So this is not an Hamiltonian for the gauge theory. This is not a gauge theory. This is just the Ising model.
So you are saying that Ising model can be dual to a gauged.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the duality is a non-local mapping, as you can see. Okay. So, but now you see that because the topologically ordered phase corresponds through duality to the paramagnet, then all the correlation functions do decay exponentially because it's like a paramagnet. Okay. So this is what we wanted. We wanted a system that had a degeneracy, but there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the operator that does not commute with your local symmetry, which is the AN operator, will not have a non-vanishing expectation value, and the correlation functions of these operators will decay exponentially. It's what we want. At this point, we finally need to address the problem of making this theory physical. Because I'll come to you in a second. Because this Hilbert space is a bit weird because it's the tensor product of some local degrees of freedom, but then you have these two non-local Hilbert spaces. We don't like that. Okay? Yes?
Yeah, so what does topologically ordered mean? Because previously we referred to the paramagnetic state as something disordered and where the correlation functions are decaying.
Yeah.
So what new conclusions do we have?
Yeah, so in the mu variables, it's a paramagnet.
Yes.
But in the B variables, it's topologically ordered. What does it mean? That there is a degeneracy and that this degeneracy is topological. Because what we mean by that is that the algebra in the ground space is made of topologically non-trivial operators that are these non-contractible loops. And as a consequence, because the number of such operators is given by G, the degeneracy is topological, it's 2 to the 2G. But other than that, it looks like a disordered phase. In the sense that there is no local order parameter and correlation functions are decaying. So for a long time, people thought, this is just a disordered phase. They actually didn't notice very much this issue about the degeneracy, and they didn't know, anyway, nobody mentions it, but if somebody noticed that, they didn't know what to do with it. So it was not an interesting characteristics. So for them, it was just a disordered phase. It is a consequence of having in mind that you define order as a symmetry breaking. Now, this is not symmetry breaking, so you just call it a disorder. But now I'm asking you to renew our definition and saying, hey, this phase is not just a paramagnet. It has an interesting degeneracy. It has a gap. And these states cannot be connected by local operations. This is actually very interesting. So it is some kind of order, and I call it topological order. Okay? Oh, by the way, so this goes without saying, but because there is a quantum phase transition between J and G in the ISIM model, then by duality, also the gap in the topological, in the lattice gauge theory shrinks at the critical point. And actually, one can show that shrinks exactly in the same way. So now let's make this physical. The toric code. So Kitaev was the first one to realize that actually the quantum lattice gauge theory has very interesting characteristics because this topological degeneracy, we will get there, but can be very, very useful. For one thing, there is already one reason why we should suspect that this is very interesting, because you remember that when you have symmetry breaking, you have a global symmetry, And this implies the existence of a local order parameter. Let me call it x, which is local. Well, let me call it O, and it's local. And then the algebra in the ground space is T and O. And this means that there is a preferred basis. You remember that? That's why there is a spontaneous symmetry break. The preferred basis is the basis in which T looks like this. Remember that? Reason is, in the basis that is connected, because this is the algebra, right? So this means that there is some basis, chi1, chi2, such that you have this. And because these are local, then these states, chi1 and chi2, that are the symmetric states, cannot be stable. The only stable states are those that break the symmetry, the ones, the other basis, psi1, psi2. So you see, if this maps this in this, means it has these matrix elements in this basis. So these states are robust. These are the symmetry breaking states. These states are fragile. These are the symmetric states. But now, our algebra, which is made of W1x and W1z, in fact, we have, because it's a four-fold degeneracy, we have two copies of this algebra, the one with one and the one with two. W1x and W1z are dual to each other. This is a loop, this is a loop. It's not like there is one local and one non-local. So it seems that in some sense, all the bases in L are equivalent, and therefore, there is not a preferred one. So Kitaev thought, hey, maybe there is a way of making it to have all the, because they are all the same, if one of them is robust, they are all robust. They're all stable. And this is amazing, right? Because now you have a qubit that is stable no matter how you prepare it. There is no difference between a Schrödinger cat and one of the so-called favorite pointer bases. Okay, so this is his reasoning. So what does he do? We understand that the gauge Hilbert space is weird. It's not good. So we would like to have the same physics, but in H top. Can we have the same physics in H top? You know, at first it seems impossible, but actually it's very easy. I mean, after you learn that, it's very easy. Very technically, it's very easy. So you have our Hamiltonian, now it's an Hamiltonian on H dot, I will call it Hamiltonian of the toric code. And we will still have this term. Let me call it J, okay? So I'm thinking in the G equals zero limit. And now he says, okay, let me add this term and now imagine that U is much, much larger than J. So this means that what is my spectrum like? Okay, you see A and B operators commute with each other, right? So the whole spectrum can be now, which is also a basis for the Hilbert space, now is given by this, oh, this is not IP, say N. I give a configuration of AN, then I give a configuration of BP, and then I have, we know that, so how many labels do I have? L squared minus one and L squared minus one. So I still have those two other labels. They are non-local, okay, but my Hilbert space is just, the Hilbert space is local. It's just the tensor product of all the spins. But these are the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. Okay. So the ground state in particular, you see, every time I put plus one here, I have an energy minus U, and here I have an energy minus J when this is plus one. So the ground space is again, when all of these are plus one, and all of these are plus one, and these are whatever, because they commute with the Hamiltonian. They commuted before, they commute now. Okay, so the ground space is again for the degenerate, and the energy right now is minus n u plus j. Now, what is the first excited state? You flip what?
B.
B. Okay, and you can flip two of them, not one. Right? So we have a gap for J, and we have the same states as before. And then we keep flipping B, because every time I flip B, I go up in energy of for J, order J. At some point, I've flipped all the Bs, and now I can start flipping the A. But when I flip the A, again, I have to flip two of them. So I have another gap, which is much larger, that is ordered for U. And now I have states where I have flipped some A. But if I am at low energy, so let L low be the subspace in H tot such that the expectation value of your Hamiltonian for psi in H low is much smaller than U, or let me say just smaller than U, right? So as you can see, L low is these states where all the A are one. And what does it mean for A being one? That A n psi is equal to psi. So you see the low energy sector of the toric code is the Z2 gauge theory. But we do not have this artificial gauge constraint. It is energetically imposed. So saying that those states do not exist makes the Hilbert space non-local. But gapping them away makes the Hilbert space local. You still don't see them because they are at very high energy. So one can say, okay, you know, the gauge theory is emergent at low energies. See how we make a gauge theory emergent. And now all the properties that we learned are still true because it's the same space. In particular, the properties of the ground space. And there is one more property that we can check, and it's more general in the toric code than in the gauge theory. And it is this one. Imagine, okay, so let me rewrite my Hamiltonian. Imagine I add a perturbation. Okay, so Vj are some local operators and the coupling is lambda. One example is if we add a magnetic field in the x direction. At that point, we were forced to put it in the x direction because everything had to be gauge invariant. And now we don't care. Now we are in the full theory. We could put anything we want. Okay. So any perturbation, as long as it is local. So in fact, this perturbation Vj does not need to respect any symmetry of the Hamiltonian. Can be random operator. So I'm breaking everything. Okay, there is no gauge symmetry, there is no BP symmetry, it's nothing. What happens? Do we still have topological order? In particular, since for us the interesting property is this degeneracy. And this gap, the question is, if I perturb the system, do I split this degeneracy? Which is the same of saying, then there is a tunneling amplitude between this state and this state, right? In perturbation theory. We have seen this multiple times in many different ways in this course. So splitting the degeneracy also means I can have a transition between the states, or therefore they are fragile. Okay, so we want to compute. Now let me call this gap is whatever it is. Okay, yeah, this is delta. Let me call this splitting. Let me call it delta E. Okay. And this is my question. What is this like? Okay. So how do we do degenerate perturbation theory? What do we do? We take our ground state. We take our perturbation. And we diagonalize this operator within this space, right? So psi zero belongs to L ground state. This is what we have to do. We diagonalize it, and then the difference between the two eigenvalues is the splitting. Okay. But definitely, in order to be something to diagonalize, means that, so if I build this matrix, I will look, or these are psi and psi prime. These are two different states. So I will look at these matrix elements, right? So let's look at the off-diagonal matrix element. This is what is important. Because if the off-diagonal matrix elements are zero, then this means that you're not splitting the degeneracy. It's already diagonal. It's already those two eigenvalues that are the same, and you're not splitting, right? So you need non-vanishing of diagonal elements to split the degeneracy. Which means that you must have, look at this, a non-vanishing tunneling amplitude of Vj between these two states. You are asking that your perturbation connects the two states in a ground space. Okay, so I'm not saying anything very profound. I'm just reminding you some basic facts about perturbation theory. Okay, now Vj is a local operator. And we know that psi prime, which is an order of the states in the ground space, can be written as one of our w's times psi zero. So we are asking whether this state has some overlap with this state. But these two states have to be orthogonal because we know that this is topologically non-trivial, and this is a local operator, so it will be topologically trivial. So these two states will be orthogonal. But this is just the first order in perturbation theory. What happens at the second order in perturbation theory? The second order in perturbation theory, well, now I cannot pull the sum out, right? I have this. And now you will see that I will have, term by terms, when I expand that, I will have Vj, Vj prime. Oh, this is still local. It doesn't work. However, at some order in perturbation theory, so when n times r, r is the locality of Vj, Vj is a local r local operator, is equal to L, then it is possible that one of these products, so now we have a product of n r operators, which means a product of L operators, one of these operators could be topologically non-trivial. So now it could have some overlap with this one. So the splitting must happen at this order in perturbation theory. So it must be of the order of lambda to the power n, which means L over R. Now, of course, if lambda is a very strong coupling, then this drives us out of the topological phase, right? For instance, imagine this is sigma x, we go in the polarized phase. But for lambda small enough, say smaller than one, or smaller than a number order one, so. But so let me say it's smaller than one. I'm not losing generality in saying that. I am still in the topological phase. I mean, I'm close to the topological phase. But now, if this is smaller than one, this scales like e to the minus l over r. So in the thermodynamic limit, the splitting goes to zero very quickly. And this is amazing. Because now you see, no, this degeneracy, no matter how you break the symmetries, cannot be split. Typically, it's not like that. Every time you have a degeneracy, it's because there is some symmetry. You break the symmetry, you split it, you know? Zeeman effect. Or when we talked about our quantum phase transition, we explicitly break the symmetry, putting a field in the z direction. Oh, I suddenly open a gap between the two degenerate states. But this gap this degeneracy is robust. A consequence of this is that if I prepare my ground state in any superposition inside this ground space, and then I perturb the Hamiltonian, the tunneling amplitude from one of the states to an orthogonal one is zero in the thermodynamic limit. So in every basis, this is robust, which is very different from what happens when you have symmetry breaking, where you have a preferred basis. Now, here there are many subtleties, one of which is that the way I am perturbing the state is by just perturbing the Hamiltonian. So, in order, and looking at the ground state, so we are at equal zero. So these are non-thermal noise. Thermal noise is more stronger and more complicated, and we will have to go to higher dimensional generalization of the toric code. But at equal zero, the ground space is robust. All the tunneling amplitudes due to perturbations of the Hamiltonian go to zero. And this is amazing because if you can, you know, do quantum computation, then you have something that even if you make a mistake in your Hamiltonian, well, nothing happens. So you see, topological order is actually very, very useful. And this is because it's not symmetry breaking. If there was symmetry breaking, then there would be a local operator that connects these two states. And then this tunneling amplitude will be given by perturbation theory, depending on the gap, right? It's 1 over the gap to the power of the order in perturbation theory in which that happens. So you see a very simple argument in perturbation theory, but we are standing on the shoulders of giants, shows that the ground space of the toric code has this amazing property that we like very much. Yeah.
So do they try to do this in like quantum calculus or trying to?
Yes. So there are people at UCSB and Microsoft, Station Q especially, they are very big in being a topological quantum computer, which is a quantum computer that, instead of using error correction, is robust at the physical level. So in order to be robust at the physical level, at the very least means that your memory register should be robust, so that if you encode a qubit in the superposition of these two states, should stay put. Of course, the big problem is this, right? So, you know, this would take us too far, but let me just say that the problem at finite temperature is still an open problem. It's a research problem. There are many, there is a lot of progress, but it's still a feasible model that would work at finite temperature. It's not something that we have yet. Then the second ingredient to do a quantum computer is that you not only want to encode information, you also want to manipulate it, right? So you must have some logical operations, and the logical operations should be robust. And we know what are the logical operations within this space. It's the algebra. The algebra is the set of operators that have a non-trivial effect in this space. This is what an algebra is. And we have seen that it's made of topological operators. So the hope is that, okay, if my noise is such that this logical operator is deformed in this way, well, it's still the same logical operator because it's topological. So that's the philosophy behind that. Of course, the technical aspects of this are very complicated. Yes, what's your question?
My question is more technically, how do you compute a non-local logical operator?
So how you realize them, right? Or how you read out the information. Yes, that's not easy. But there is a scheme that takes polynomial resources, not exponential resources, made of so-called syndrome measurements that allow you to either prepare the states or and do the readout. From the point of view of making that operator, we need another piece of information that I'm going to give you right now. Okay. But now I will remark on how this is useful for quantum computation at the end, but let's stay just strictly on the physics side. I want to show you that not only this model features a robust degeneracy and then an emergent Z2 gauge theory, but it also features emergent bosons and fermions. So you see here there are no bosons and fermions. There are just spins. But now I want to show you that you will have particles that are localized and they behave like bosons and fermions. Okay, so how do we do that? We do it this way. Let's start with bosons. Okay. So we will say that our localized particles are the excitations of the system. So what is an excitation of the system is, I place a -1 here in this plaquette and a -1 here in this other plaquette. Or I place a -1 here on this star. You understand what I mean? I mean that the eigenvalue of this will be -1. And maybe another one here. It's a feature of this model that I can only create these excitations in pairs. Okay? Good. Now, so this state, the state of two excitations can be written as a string state over the ground space. So it can be written like, imagine I draw this string on the dual lattice. So it's, remember, it's the one that carries x. And as you can see, this open string will never create an excitation along the string, right? Because bad drawing. Because it always crosses the plaquette in an even number of spins. Okay, now it's okay. But at the end points, I create exactly the excitations that I want. So I can write any excited state as I start from a state in the ground state, in the ground space, and I operate with W, X, gamma. Now gamma is not closed. And what is important of gamma are just the endpoints. Let me call them A, B. So in fact, every homotopic string would do the same thing. Would create exactly the same state.
So W X is composed with sigma X, right?
Yeah. So this string is creating a couple of Z2 excitations of the type B that we will call vortices. From now on, these are called Z2 vortices. And if instead I have a string running on the links, like this one, so the one that carries Z, by the same token, the stars that are in between will be crossed twice. So now I create a pair of Z2 charges. Okay, so these are particles, they are localized. And right now they are eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, so they stay put. If I want to give a dynamics to these particles, I have to perturb a little bit the Hamiltonian, and therefore they will not be eigenstates anymore and they will start moving around, of course in a superposition, because it's a quantum system, okay? And now I'm thinking, what type of particles are they? Okay. So for instance, let me again take this. Okay, so I have a particle here and a particle here. So, okay, so this is my state. Okay, this is A and this is B. And now I want to understand if they are bosons or fermions or something else. But let's stick with the idea that we learned at the beginning of quantum theory, that there are only bosons and fermions. For the moment, let's stick with that, okay? How do I know if two particles are bosons and fermions?
Exchange the two particles.
Yes, perfectly. So remember, how do we do that? We know that they are indistinguishable particles. So you either have a completely symmetric or completely anti-symmetric wave function. In the completely symmetric wave function, it's completely symmetric means if you swap the particles, you get a plus one. In the completely anti-symmetric function, if you swap the two particles, you get a minus one. Okay? So let's try to understand algebraically how we realize the swap. So what I want to do is to swap them, swap A and B, and see what I get. If I get to the same state with a plus one, then I know they're bosons. If I get the same state with a minus one, then I know they're fermions. If not, maybe they're not particles. No, I don't know what they are. Okay. Or maybe there's something else that I don't want to discuss right now. Okay, so how do I swap this? Well, one way is to take this particle and drag it up to here. Okay? And then I take this particle and I drag it up to here. So the composition of these two operations is the swap. Now let's look at this operation. Okay? And let's say that now I define this string. As you can see, if I apply this string to this plaquette, I will actually move it from here to here. Okay. Look at just one of them. Okay. Now let me add the string up to here. Okay. So when I add this string, this means that now this plaquette has two axes. So the particle disappears from here. It does not appear here because, sorry, it does not appear inside here because there are two axes. It does not appear here because there are two axes. It does not appear here because there are two axes, but it gets here because there is only one x. So my string operators actually move the particles. And then I have to do the swap on the particle B, I have to act with this other one. And the composition of the two, the product of the two, is the swap operator. So you see that the swap operator is a loop. Okay? So let me call it W gamma closed. And I am, so this is my swap operator, times this thing I had before, psi 0. OK. Now, obviously, these two operators commute, right? They are all made of axes. OK. This is the ground state. Now, this is a loop. OK? And the loop is the product of A's. And the product of A's, and each, they all commute, so it doesn't matter the order in which I take them. And A on psi 0, psi 0 is the ground state, gives me what?
Plus 1.
Mm-hmm. OK? So each A gives me plus 1. So this is psi 0 again. So here I get swap on this state gives me again the same state. Oh, they're bosons. So Z2 vortices are bosons. And the Z2 charges that are completely dual to the Z2 bosons, you can see they do exactly the same. Only to move them, I have to use the Z strings that run on the links. So both Z2 vortices and Z2 charges are bosons. OK. Interesting. Now, good. We have emergent bosons. What about fermions? Yeah.
4 minutes.
4 minutes, okay. So I will give you a first part of the explanation, then I leave the second part as an exercise. Imagine that I have two Z2 charges. So this is a Z string, right? This is a Z string. And then I have two Z2 vortices. Let me draw it like this. So this means this is some X string. Okay. And let me do the drawing in a less complicated way, otherwise it seems okay. So this is a pair of vortices, and this is a pair of charges. And let's say I want to take a charge around the vortex, or a vortex around the charge, it's the same. So for instance, to take it around, I have to do this. So I do that path. Okay.
What's the operation? Is this?
Huh?
What's this operation?
Yeah, so by now you know that moving means that I act with the Z string when I move the charges. Okay, so let me say that I move it just up to here. Okay, it still went around. Okay, so you see that my psi out, so after I dragged it around, is equal to this string. Okay, so I have this string times this loop, and then I have my psi in, my initial state. And what is my initial state? My initial state is this string and this string, right? So I have a WZ, if I call this A, B, C, D, I have WZ between A and B, and WX between C and D. Okay. Now this loop, which is made of Z, right, obviously commutes with this one. Right, because everything is made of Z. But what about, I want to drag it here. So what about the commutation between this loop and WX, and WXCD? They anti-commute. So this means that if I bring the loop here, I will have my little piece of string times WZAB times WXCD times my loop, let me make it in blue, times psi zero. With a minus, because they anti-commute. With a minus. But the loop on psi zero is psi zero. Because again, the loop is the product of placket operators. Each placket operator gives me a plus one. So you see all this algebra that we built. Now how easy makes the things. So this is just psi zero. And, but this times this on psi zero gives me psi in. So we are left with minus psi in. Oh, so we learned something, that if I drag one type of excitation around the other type of excitation, no matter what is the path, any loop would do. No matter how far they are apart, right? They're very, very, very far. Okay, and I do this. I get a phase minus one. This is the Aronoff-Bohm effect. When you drag a charge around the flux, you get a phase for your wave function. In that case, it's a U1 phase, because your gauge theory is U1. This is the baby of the theory, the Z2. You only have two levels, but remember Plato, right? So you get the Aronoff-Bohm effect. I'm done. Exercise for you. Imagine that now I have the bound state of two vortices and two charges. I have to draw it like this because it's like this, right? And they're bound. That bound means that somehow I glued them because there is some force that keeps them together. So now they are glued together. And I know how to move them. I have at the same time use an X string and a Z string to move them together. And now swap them. If you do all the calculations, you will see that when you swap them, this object here twists. Not here. That when you swap them, there is a twist between the strings that are swapping. And so now when you swap, you get a minus. Because if a Z string and X string cross, then they will anti-commute. So try to do it as an exercise. This means that the bound state of a Z2 vortex and Z2 charge is also a localized particle, right? Is this blue particle that has some internal structure, but it is this blue particle. It's a fermion. Okay, we're done for today. This means that a spin system has emergent Z2 theory, bosons, and fermions. One can repeat this construction in a much more complicated way using more complicated gauge groups, both discrete and continuous. But your original degrees of freedom are quote unquote spins. They're not spin one off. They are multi-level systems. Or they are, in the case of continuous gauge theory, they're continuous variables. But you can redo that. And so you can have emergent particles that have any property that you want. You can have gravitons. You can have photons. You can have any gauge theory. You can do the standard model from an underlying lattice of spins. And that's very interesting, you see? It's very, very interesting. Because you ask the question, is the so-called fundamental physics fundamental or emergent? You don't know because your quantum field theory is effective, right? It means that you know it's true up to a cutoff. It means that the cutoff is the lattice spacings when you don't see your underlying structure. So you see how these things connect with, high energy theory and quantum information and all these other things. Okay, so it's all for today. And yeah, so I don't know if tomorrow you want to hear a little bit more of this, or we can start to the new topic that is about what happens away from equilibrium, so not the ground states anymore. We'll talk about that tomorrow.